got our start working with ODOT, PBOT, TriMet, and Metro. And so the 9 stops that we have, it was really up to those transit agencies to come up with them, and they based their decision on how it currently interfaces with the rest of the transit network and where there is ample demand. So we created an operational feasibility study back in, I think it was 2019, and it's out on our website, and it shows how it connects and integrates to the rest of the transit system.
And has there been other ferries that existed in Portland and Vancouver before Frog Ferry?
There have. And so residents of the Portland area will recognize like the word, Boone's Ferry Road or Taylor's Ferry Road. You know, these are roads that used to match up to ferry landings. And there used to be a ferry that connected from Vancouver, Washington, up to the northern part of Portland, just crisscrossing the Columbia River. And that was over 100 years ago, the same month that we opened the I-5 bridge, because we had this new thing called the automobile, the same month that we shut down that ferry system.
Ah. And you mentioned that you are at the state capitol today, and what are you asking for at the state capitol?
So we have requests into state legislators. There is a 2025 transportation package being considered by our elected leaders. We have a request in for funding there. The total request we're asking for the state is $10 million. So we've got a request in there. And then we also have a capital construction request in as well. So right now we're pursuing the two different avenues of funding with the state with the hope that one of those will work out for us.
And what has the reaction been from lawmakers so far?
Well, honestly, they seem delighted that we're back. This is actually our third session. Frog Ferry was founded 8 years ago, May, and we went down there and made the rounds and asked for funding for the first feasibility study, and we were asking for $250,000. And candidly, they're like, we like the premise of this, but that's just not enough money for a transit project. You know, it was hard to be taken seriously. So we've done a lot of learning since then. We had partnered with PBOT. They'd given us a match. We got an ODOT Statewide Transit Improvement Fund grant, or SIF grant, actually was awarded two of those that allowed us to do some of the studies along with, you know, the fundraising we have done with the private sector and foundations. So now that we're back, because, you know, they weren't convening in person during COVID in 2021, and then 2 years ago, we had a request in, but we weren't working it as hard as we are now. And I think they're delighted to see a grassroots effort of concerned citizens, particularly at a time when these public agencies just don't have the resources to pursue a new transit mode.
And what would the next steps be after getting approval?
Well, we have this request with the state, but we also are requesting, we like to say a handshake and not a handout, with the city council. So we are asking for a letter or a memorandum of some sort saying, yes, we're going to partner to pursue this project, much like Mayor Wheeler did with Major League Baseball before he left office. And that's really the state legislators want to see that signal of support from city council. And we plan to apply for PSEF funding. And PSEF now has a transportation decarbonization category within its grant program. And that's due in late May. So we are really pushing city council for that memo of understanding. So we've got those two paths right now, our request in with the city in anticipation of asking PSEF for money. And I want to be very clear, we're not asking for general fund from the city. It would be through PSEF, and then with the state. Those are really the two things we need to secure in order to move forward.
Thank you for clarifying that, by the way, for our listeners.
You bet.
And how often do you rally for support for the Frog Ferry?
Oh, gosh. I think my board would say it's probably daily, but in terms of rallying for support, I mean, there's so many different ways of doing that. Sometimes it's individuals that know elected officials to put in a call for us or a call to ask for a meeting. Currently, we just are posting on our socials asking for residents to write city council. I mean, this is the time. And we're not going to hang around for another 6 months or year and come back a year from now. I mean, we have provided $40 million now of value, with less than 1% of that coming from public funding, because, you know, ferries are just a best practice. So, you know, our 3,400 supporters and stakeholders, you know, strongly, you know, believe we should be pursuing this. And so there's a letter writing campaign right now. In another hour, I'll be at City Hall making the rounds with four or five leaders from the Downtown Neighborhood Association, the St. John's Neighborhood, as well as the Frogberry Board. So there are times when it's seven times a week, but in terms of the general public, you know, it's been sporadic. We've had river runs. We've had rallies at City Halls. We've had press conferences. We've had funding campaigns and year-end campaigns. But right now, this is, you know, a very significant push for us.
And have you faced any opposition trying to launch Frog Ferry? And if you have, what is the most common opposition against Frog Ferry?
Well, again, we embarked on this 8 years ago, and we've had a couple obstacles. One, we don't have an understanding of ferries here, both from, you just think of civic planners, transit planners. If you're starting a new ferry service, for instance, in Seattle, as they're looking at like Seattle to Des Moines service or Seattle to Tacoma service, they know ferries. They've had ferries for 65 years up there. And so they just organizationally, they've got systems in place and they understand the benefits, and also residents understand the benefits. Whereas here, it's a new mode to us. Because, you know, most of us weren't around 100 years ago. The other thing has been just looking at budget shortfalls. Both PBOT and ODOT have had budget shortfalls. We actually picked up pursuing the ferry operational feasibility study back in 2018 when it was in the proposed budget for PBOT and it got cut. And that's when we got the call and were, you know, it was just suggested that we might be able to come up with the funding and apply for ODOT funds and complete the feasibility study. So now PBOT's had, you know, 8 years in a row of budget shortfalls. And so with that means, oh gosh, you know, from a public agency perspective, and I've got 20 years with public agencies, so I'm, you know, highly sympathetic to where they are, and the fact that we've got so much deferred maintenance and, you know, infrastructure challenges. And so they're going to focus on, you know, kind of their backfilling their budgets, and it's been next to impossible to start something new. For us as concerned citizens, we're just saying we just don't see a future where we can continue to approach our transportation infrastructure the way we have. I mean, lots more pavement and asphalt. You know, we have a difficult time maintaining the roads we have, filling the potholes we have, you know, shoveling the roads we have, particularly when ferries are so inexpensive from a capital perspective, CapEx, as well as from an operational perspective, because you don't have to fill a pothole on the river. You don't have to shovel a river, and, you know, and there's just a reliability around the operation, and that the cost for operations is really a fraction of other transit modes. And I would say, lastly, we really want to get more people using transit. And as a best practice, we've seen how ferries are actually a mode. They're considered a gateway transit. They'll get people out of their single occupancy vehicles because they're so excited to take a ferry, and they'll take a bus there or light rail or shuttle, or they'll hop on their bike to take the ferry because it's so enjoyable and it's a really, you know, just a beautiful use of time. So those have been the principal obstacles, and just needing to persevere through that and say, hey, we've got a 2035 climate action plan. We're falling behind, and we can't not do this. So some of this is being we don't like to think of ourselves as disruptive, but it is in terms of kind of the status quo planning and saying we've got to innovate and grab on to this best practice for the future of our community.
And is there any plans to expand to the different cities and docks once approved in the future?
Yes. So the pilot project is from Cathedral Park at St. John's down to River Place on the southwest waterfront in Portland using existing docks. But the vision is for Vancouver to Oregon City. And again, that's not based on what we think it should be, but what transit planners have said. That said, we've heard from West Lynn and Camas and Ridgefield and St. Helens and further up the gorge saying, hey, could you ever have a ferry extend here? And those are all possibilities. And again, we're not trying to be, kind of precious about where the ferry should go. We really want to respond to where there's the greatest need from the public.
And what do you wish people knew about the Frog Ferry project?
Oh, gosh, I so appreciate that question. I wish they knew of the amazing group of people that are behind this effort and of the incredible love for Portland and hope we have for Portland's future.
And if our listeners want to learn more about the Frog Ferry project, what is the best way for them to do that?
They can go to frogferry.com, and there's an opportunity to sign up for our newsletter there, and there's a lot of information on there, and I can always be reached at susan@frogferry.com.
And do you have any final thoughts for our interview?
Oh, Kenny, it's really that this is the time. I know that your listeners have been hearing about Frog Ferry for many years, but this is the crunch time, and we're very excited and encouraged by this new city council. We know that it's a really challenging time for them and with the budget crunch, but we also need to plan for our future and for our future generations. And I've had legislators say to me, you are delivering this on a silver platter. You've done the work, you've de-risked the project, and now we're simply asking for city council to say we're going to partner with this. Yes, we're going to allow you to use the city docks. There's a very, low risk to all of this, and so that we can move it forward. And so for your listeners, I highly encourage them to write to city council or call into their offices and voice their support. That would mean the world to us.
That was KBOO News In Depth with Susan Bladholm, founder and president of Frog Ferry. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Kenny B.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I talked to Ned Blackhawk. He's a University of Washington graduate and a history professor at Yale University, who won this past year's National Book Award in Nonfiction, among other honors, for his latest book. It's titled The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. It offers perspective on questions about citizenship and the shaping of what America is today through the power, agency, and survival of indigenous peoples. Blackhawk includes the history of indigenous people in the Pacific Northwest, such as the oldest continuously operating Native American boarding school, which is in Salem, Oregon. Here's my conversation with Professor and author Ned Blackhawk. How did you end up being one of the Hatfield Series speakers for the Oregon Historical Society?
It probably isn't too complicated, but they let me know early in their calendar that they wanted me to come talk out there, and I was very honored and excited, and so I worked my schedule so that I could take some time off from my teaching schedule to be there.
And they were really excited too when they heard that you won this National Book Award for your most recent
work. Correct, yeah. So I had accepted this invitation long before I'd gotten that and a few other fairly prominent prizes for my book.
Yes. And what was that moment like for you to be recognized like that among other writers for your work?
It was really quite both kind of gratifying, but also overwhelming. I've had a few people ask me whether I knew about these types of things before I received some of these honors. And I generally say that I'm not that familiar with the kind of publishing world outside of my own scholarly areas. So my book is with a university press at the school that I work at, and I know the people there fairly well. And I never really anticipated like the foreign language editions and all the kind of notoriety that has come. But obviously, so it's that's overwhelming, but also very gratifying as well.
Yeah, congratulations are in order, definitely.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Let's talk for a moment about the substance of the book, The Rediscovery of American Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. Describe to me why that is the title and why is that so important, The Rediscovery of America?
The title refers to, as I indicate early on in the introduction, to the fact that there has been an incredible profusion of academic inquiry around these subjects for quite some time. For more than a generation, professional scholars and tribal members and others have been actively engaged in creating new paradigms and understandings about the history of North America. I suggest that we're living through this major period of rediscovery of American history, or that there is this rediscovery of American history that has unfolded. And so this book is an attempt to bring together the findings of many others. And so it's a work of interpretive synthesis. It's an overview. It's by no means comprehensive, but it's an attempt to say that we're at a kind of new moment in American historical inquiry where we can no longer uniformly unrecognize or underrecognize the centrality of Native Americans to U.S. history.
For so long, when we were in school, even I can remember when we're taught about American history, it was through the eyes of Christopher Columbus discovered America. And then you think about that, he discovered a place where there had already been people living here for thousands of years. So really, it does entail a major rewriting of the narratives that we've had for so long in our country.
And I'm really indebted to all those who've done the hard work to make visible some of these subjects. It's been really quite extraordinary to be part of this generation of scholars who has risen both professionally and intellectually into a space where these things historically have not operated. And so I am trying to generate broad attention to this broad field transformation. And so the Hatfield Lectures are a great place to have this conversation.
Yeah. And you're going over five centuries of history in this book. So there's obviously a ton of material in here. But I thought maybe we could touch upon especially some of the topics that you touched on in the West and the Pacific mm-hmm. Northwest, which is where much of our audience is. First, the Union victory recalibrated Native communities across the West. Describe that part of the book to me.
The Civil War forms in many ways the crucible of American history. And it is in many ways the moment at which what we consider a modern America emerges. Before the Civil War, the Union is incredibly divided. It's very weak, and it's dealing with very deep kind of constitutional failures that it's unable to resolve. These involve the continued expansion of human enslavement and related problems of state governance versus federal authority. And eventually, 7 and then 11 states of the Confederacy secede. They form their own country called the Confederate States of America. And those two countries go to war with one another. And the Union eventually reincorporates the South into a reconstructed American after 1865 and the Civil War's formal ending militarily. That period of Civil War transforms the capacity of the federal government in so many ways. The military grows nearly exponentially. The railroad connects the country for the first time. The government is able to tax and issue currency and essentially begin a monetary practice of federal governance that it never has beforehand. The federal government becomes a visible part, essentially, of people's lives, often for the first time. It grows in standing and numbers, and particularly in places like the South, where the Freedmen's Bureau and other government institutions are trying to reintegrate Southern society into the Union. This is happening out West, though, as well. And so I don't talk about the Pacific Northwest in great detail during the 1860s and 70s. I talk about it beforehand. I talk about it afterwards. So generally, though, in the West, the federal government is dramatically expanding its footprint in places and upon peoples. And so I focus largely upon the federal government's footprint upon American Indians, which include the kind of emergence of initially large-scale reservations across much of particularly interior Northwest and Northern Plains and Western Rocky Mountain regions. There's a series of monumental treaties that are signed in the aftermath of the Civil War that create vast domains of Indian territory in places like Montana, Utah, Arizona, North and South Dakota, interior state of Washington. And these large reservations then are created by treaties and ratified by the federal government and Senate. And so they become the kind of administrative domain of a growing power of the federal government to regulate Western lands and peoples. And over time, Western ranchers and resource interests and eventually railroads will start cobbling away a lot of those land holdings. But for a while, the federal government is making a very large commitment to incorporating the West through this treaty process that has a lot of under-recognized legacies and components. And so in the Northwest, some of the big legacies, particularly north of Oregon, but to a lesser extent also in Oregon, are the fishing right guarantees that these treaties make. And so we're celebrating the 50th year of the Bolt decision in the state of Washington, ruling by federal judge George Bolt, who upheld the treaty rights of Puget Sound Indian fishers to continue fishing at usual and accustomed places. That's a treaty right inscribed into one of their treaties from the 1850s with Governor Isaac Stevens in the territory. So that history is in many ways still with us or is ongoing, even though those large reservations became heavily targeted and often alienated because of these other interests that I was alluding to.
Yeah. And I know that there are, even today, there are so many of the rights are still being argued about, especially when it comes to water. There's almost a war over water going on in the West. And a lot of the Native communities are in particular are really concerned about seeing their water poisoned by toxins.
Or they're left out of water resource agreements that mm-hmm. states are making. So that was a big case with the Navajo Nation that I was somewhat aware of and partly involved in. But for example, the boarding school system starts emerging across the West during this period. And so Oregon has one of the oldest continues to run Indian boarding schools at Chemawa that attracts Indians from not just Oregon, but across the Northwest and even Alaska. And so that's one of those institutional footprints that the federal government is building across Indian country and across really much of North America during this period. And there's a map in my book of approximately 70 federally run or funded boarding schools across North America during this era.
And there were many in Canada as well. And there are many court cases involved with the mistreatment of children.
And Canada's parliament established something known as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 2005 or 2007 about to offer some kind of large scale overview of that subject. Mm-hmm. And they issued a recent final report that called this process one of cultural genocide, in which 150,000 Aboriginal children were forcibly removed from their parents and families and kept often in unsanitary and hostile conditions at often bleak institutional settings.
Let's talk a moment about this part of the book where you mention California Indians were targeted by federally funded militias and they were among the first casualties of the Civil War. And I did not know that. Can you go into detail about that a bit?
Sure. It's a little bit of a kind of provocative assertion, but it's grounded in fairly sound academic study. But the provocative assertion is to convey the extent and depth of the Civil War's transformations across the West and to essentially unmake, as that's the theme of the book, some of the kind of conventional paradigms for thinking of American history more broadly. So the battle between the North and the South, which is at the heart of the study of American history, has largely excluded Western North America, almost entirely, to be honest. And so to say that California Indians are some of the first casualties of the Civil War is to take an intervention in that conversation and to provoke these types of questions like, how is that possible? Or what are you talking about? Or when did this happen? And so I can say, based on the studies of others, that throughout the 1860s, the federal government is starting to mobilize itself to fight the South in a kind of organized military way, following the South's secession and following initial shots fired by Confederate forces against Union forces at Southern forts and other locations, and begins mobilizing its state populations and eventually starts enlisting state citizens in the Union Army. Before it does that, it starts sending subsidies to state legislatures to begin processes of troop recruitment and training and mobilizations and like fort constructions of various kind. And in California, which has already had a kind of ongoing set of state organized militias against Native Americans, particularly in Northern California and certain kind of Sierra Mountain homelands, these state militias essentially start getting federal funding to continue their wars against Indians. And so in the spring of 1861, before the Battle of Bull Run, in the summer of 1861, state militia forces in Northern California's Humboldt County are indiscriminately killing Indians, as they've been doing for 18 months or so, because Native peoples are poaching their cattle and making settlement hard. And so these state militias are now receiving federal funding. And I suggest then that they are actually the casualties of those campaigns are among the first casualties of the Civil War, because Civil War is the kind of growing commitment of the federal government to use violence and military campaigns to enforce federal goals. And so now all of a sudden, the kind of state level violence is becoming a federal priority. And this is happening not just in California. I read about the Dakota War in Minnesota, the Sand Creek Massacre in Colorado, the Long Walk of the Navajos in the Southwest, the Bear River Massacre in Idaho and Utah, other campaigns in Eastern California, a place called Owens Valley. There are a lot of wars, and I could have included more potentially in the Northwest because there are also similar types of skirmishes and then larger campaigns forming. But these are the kind of more familiar studies of the West during the Civil War era.
When did the shift really happen where Native peoples were finally seen as U.S. citizens? Was that in the 1920s when that finally happened?
The final legislative commitment to make American Indians U.S. citizens does occur in 1924, and we're commemorating that 100-year anniversary this year. But the federal government had always, this is a complex subject, but the federal government had always held out the hope that eventually American Indians could become property-owning, English-speaking, Christianized, essentially assimilated American subjects. And that's why boarding schools and land alienation policies and other forms of the assimilation era were so violently imposed on Native peoples, because the federal government was trying to break up these differential sovereign and cultural communities and to impose an external vision of subjectivity upon them. And so that imposition included often this promise of some kind of citizenship. And so the problem with kind of our current understandings of American civil liberties, broadly speaking, is that we conflate citizenship with freedom and with liberty. And we think of those as kind of synonyms or interrelated subjects, which they are and have historically been for most American citizens. But for American Indians, to not be a member of one's tribal community, to not have access to one's homelands or to one's economies or to one's even family members, has been the kind of goal of the federal government in certain ways for a very long time. And citizenship alone is never going to be an adequate alternative to essentially the continuation of American Indian political and sovereign authority. And so tribal members are, in many ways, are much more concerned not about their civil liberties as granted by the federal government, but in ensuring that their tribes and their communities retain the kind of promised commitments that the federal government made through that treaty process and other things over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and over time, I think we're seeing things like, for example, the election of Mary Peltola in Alaska as the first Alaska Native woman to be elected to Congress. But again, I'm thinking, why did it take that long? And the same thing with, you know, why did it take till the 1920s for the right to vote to be granted to our Native communities? It just seems like for a democracy, we've been dragging our feet.
Right. And we need to think of American democracy as something that is not at odds with this other understanding of American kind of political autonomy for Native peoples. And the federal government, its policy leaders, its executive offices, and its Supreme Court justices have had a hard time coming to that realization. And they often are stuck with how do the constitutional rights for all Americans apply to these unique Americans, essentially. And Indians have to remind the federal government constantly that we are tribal members and U.S. citizens. And even though your laws are at odds with some of our own practices, we have a retained authority over ourselves and over our membership criteria and over our own lands and resources. And so it's a very complicated world, because what happens when non-Native people, for example, travel into those reservation spaces or marry into those families or try to obtain access to some of those resources? And then they complain that the federal government has a protection of their rights against these other tribes or other peoples, and those rights are in conflict. And so that happens very regularly in the American judicial system. And it's sometimes at odds with these kind of conventional notions of what constitutes American democracy and freedom.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I had thought you had some other ties to the Pacific Northwest. Did you go to school here, University of Washington?
Yes, I lived in Seattle for many years.
Oh, okay. So you're familiar with our neck of the woods anyway.
Yeah, and I spent some time in Portland, but not as much time in Oregon as I did Washington. Thank you for inviting me to do this.
Yeah. It's been really a pleasure talking to you about all of this, too. Okay, safe travels to you. Are you at Yale today?
Yeah, I have to teach and do some things this week. But very nice talking with you. Thank you for the invitation. Take care. Thank you, Annette.
That's award-winning author and professor Ned Blackhawk.
It's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7, Portland.
Camp is in session. Join us at the KBOO station on Friday.